Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
What up, what up, what up, everybody? Hey, it's Michael Steele. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Yes, this is where it's happening right now. And I want to welcome you to a part two conversation with the incomparable Jonathan Capehart of the Washington Post. Thank you guys so much for downloading us. Remember, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeart, and give us those five-star reviews if you so choose. We love those five-star reviews. Now, in episode one, in our conversation with Jonathan Capehart, we talked about the murder of George Floyd and the situation with Amy Cooper in New York City, who, as we all know, called the cops on another black man. Yep, this was Christian Cooper, no relation, who was just in the park watching birds and told her, hey, you need to leash your dog because the sign right there says all dogs must be leashed. Anyway, we had that conversation. Jonathan, well, he's been loading it up this week, folks. So he's got this story out about why black voters don't want Klobuchar as Biden's running mate. And in it, you get into her narrative to as a former prosecutor whose state and city are now in the national spotlight. And what is your take? What is your takeaway rather from the Biden process and the narrative that's emerged? That seems to be two narratives. One that says blacks, are owed, and specifically black women, because of the value added, number one, and number two, what they've meant to the Biden campaign to actually have him survive the primary. And the other perspective that is, well, that's all good, but at the end of the day, Biden has got to pick someone who helps him win parts of the country that he otherwise will have a difficult time winning or taking back from Donald Trump, et cetera, et cetera. How do you walk through this narrative? And this piece was actually written by Jonathan Capehart, as opposed to the references I kept giving him over Ms. Hammond's piece in the last segment, and with my apologies, certainly to Ruby Hammond. And I did read your piece, Ms. Hammond, but I just, you know, got caught up talking to Jonathan. He has that effect on me. I don't know what it is, but Jonathan? What is your view of that? How does the politics cut for you here?
Okay, so I have now written three pieces about Vice President Biden and his ruminations for VP. The first piece was, the headline was, Biden needs a black woman as his VP. Now, there are people out there, like the four women who wrote an op-ed for us and also did a video saying, you know, Biden must pick a black woman, right? And it's from that school, of thought that you were mentioning, where black people, black women are owed this position.
Right.
I do not take that tack.
Right.
The tack I took in piece number one was he should have a black woman because the numbers show from 2016 that black vote dropped significantly, and that winning back the states Hillary Clinton lost in 2016 and having an African-American running mate and getting black support are not mutually exclusive. You can do both. at the same time. And I go through the numbers, and in particular, Michigan. Hillary lost it to President Trump by 10,704 votes. But a Detroit Free Press analysis after the election showed that, you know how much the black vote dropped from 2012 to 2016? Hillary Clinton got 50,000 fewer votes out of Detroit than Barack Obama did.
All right, so
remember, Detroit, right, which is the largest black population in the country, is in Michigan. Milwaukee is in Wisconsin. Philadelphia, Pittsburgh are in Pennsylvania. You have the Democrats have large pockets of votes that came out in full force in 2008, full force in 2016. But when Barack Obama wasn't on the ballot, they stayed home, as they did, as you well remember, Chairman Steele, in 2010 when Republicans retook the House,
yeah,
and 2014 when they retook the Senate. And so I was making the numerical argument for why I thought, because he's already said he's going to choose a woman, and so I was making the argument, if you choose a black woman, here's how it will help you. I also point out that we all know, and you know this, does the vice president really have any impact on whether the candidate will win a state? We don't really have evidence of that. But what we do know is a vice presidential running mate can help add to enthusiasm. And
but that goes to that point. That's actually my point. So, and it's actually part of your point that it does go to that enthusiasm, which then drives those numbers, which gets back to why there was a 50,000 vote drop off for Hillary Clinton, because Hillary Clinton thought her relationship with black people would translate as it did for her husband. She was not her husband. Black people didn't see her the way they saw her husband. They said,
you were the one who made that point on my podcast.
Right. They saw him as the first black president, not her as the first black first lady. So that for me, the why, as you know, is the most important word in politics, is why. The answer to the question why something is, why the numbers say what they say. A lot of times what people, and I get into this conversation with Rachel Bitterkoffer quite a bit. Mm-hmm. We go back and forth on this because I get the raw numbers. I totally hear you on the numbers, but you got to understand why the numbers are what they are and what they really reflect. And I would submit to you that the drop-off had a lot less to do with Tim Kaine. It had a lot. She could have put an African-American on the ticket in 2016 and still would have lost.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because, it wouldn't have been by 50,000 vote drop-off in Michigan. It would have been in Detroit. It would have been 25. So the point is, there's got that connection between the principal, the presidential nominee, and the people is paramount. And mm-hmm. when that doesn't happen, you lose. And so, but then you have the sweetener in the case of the Democrats in this instance, they've got to get something back. And that is Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, in addition mm-hmm. to perhaps Arizona and maybe Florida, but they need one of those three black. They don't need all three. They just need one of those three back. And so the question becomes, who helps them do that? Who brings something to the ticket that Mr. Biden otherwise does not have or doesn't have enough of? I think he has enough of the black vote. And that's not to take the black vote for granted. I'm not doing that at all. I'm just saying that given what black folks have indicated their vote will be in November, he's going to have enough of that. The question then becomes, like, it's all about addition. How else do I add? Because the problem for Mr. Biden is not black women, it's white women. And I've said that on your podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the reckoning that the campaign right now is going through. They're looking at numbers, and I know they're looking at numbers that are telling them, with suburban white women, they've got to navigate that space. because it is, in my estimation, the most unreliable vote for Democrats going into November.
Yeah, you are correct. But to your point about it is a matter of addition.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that there are so many black votes that weren't cast in 2016, and I think this might be Rachel's argument as well,
right,
that's where your addition comes from, or a lot of your addition could come from.
Sure.
That black voters are the most reliable voters for the Democratic Party. You gotta get them out.
So what does it take to get them out?
So what do you do? Do you spend all your time trying to go after the unreliable suburban white female vote?
But who might have voted Republican?
But
there are more of them,
Jonathan.
There are more of them. So you've got to eat into that number. There are more of them.
You have to try to win it just with the black vote. But I don't think you cut off your nose by ignoring the deep reservoir of black votes that had not been cast. Black vote plummeted for the first time in 20 years in 2016.
Why? Why,
well,
Jonathan?
We've already talked about the why. The point I'm making But the point is, if there's a 20-year plummet in 16, that means there is a pool of votes out there that you have to bring along. You've got to give them a reason to come out to vote.
So Donald Trump is not enough of a reason?
No, he is a reason. But I'm telling you right now. That given what's given Arbery, given Floyd, given, and those are just the most graphic examples.
Right.
But then you throw in kids in cages, coronavirus, disproportionate impact.
Again, that's enough for it. I think for. I don't need a black person on a ticket to go vote against those things.
I'm just telling you, black people are going to vote. I don't want anybody, because we're going to get blamed no matter what. If he loses, it's
true.
Your fault because you didn't come out to vote.
You just blame the loss on black turnout being low.
I use numbers. This isn't emotion. It's on election data.
Well, I'm just saying that would probably be the same thing here. That if black turnout in 2020 is not where, I don't know, someone thinks it should be, but it's not where they think it should be, because Biden didn't put a black person on the ticket. They're going to blame them for that.
I am talking my. Ultimately, my argument is on enthusiasm, that you're going to have a ticket that pulls out the enthusiasm,
wow,
that adds enthusiasm to the fear of a second Trump term.
I think the fear drives the enthusiasm.
But when we're talking about an election that's probably going to be decided on the margins, that's where the enthusiasm will come in. It's the equivalent of fracking for votes. You're trying to pull people out who otherwise might stay home.
But this isn't that election.
Even with the rage that is out there. And then the second piece I wrote, mm-hmm, was, okay, so
that
now that I've made
the
argument for black women, uh-huh, here's the black woman who I think it should, here are the four black women, and here's the one who I think it should be. And
right.
I say Senator Harris of California.
Right.
And then yesterday's piece was really zeroing in on the one white woman who, in all my writings about this, and when you read the stories, pay attention to this. There is only one white woman who is name-checked as unacceptable when either black commentators or activists or leaders are asked the question about Biden's pick. And Klobuchar's name is the only one that's named.
Wow.
And I make the case in my piece that, you know, some people, I bow to the reality that Joe Biden most likely is not going to listen to me, that Joe Biden could very well pick a white woman, and that for the base of the Democratic Party, it's a matter of which white woman. Some have standing, others don't. Senator Elizabeth Warren, absolutely, she has standing. And I go through the examples. My own Aunt Gloria has said from the very beginning she thinks Senator Warren should be Biden's pick.
Okay.
But the one who absolutely, positively does not have standing is Amy Klobuchar. And unfortunately, for one, because of the Mayan Burrell case in Minneapolis, 16-year-old who the AP did a reexamination of the case and uncovered new evidence. He may have been railroaded into he was found guilty of killing a 12-year-old girl. He's maintained his innocence this entire time. Who was the prosecutor? Amy Klobuchar. She was the Hennepin County prosecutor at the time. Hennepin County is where Minneapolis is.
Mm-hmm.
The man, the cop who had his knee on the neck of George Floyd.
Yeah.
No, it was not the cop in that case, but was on the force at that time and has been and was part of a group of six cops who were in a police-involved shooting in 2006 when Amy Klobuchar was a prosecutor.
Right.
So people knew about the Burrell case. People knew about, there's a story in the Washington Post about when she was prosecutor, police-involved shootings, she didn't prosecute cops. She didn't go for cops. And one of the wildest things, when I remember reading the story the first time last March, but there's a paragraph in the story where it talked about her campaign for county prosecutor and how she was going to go after, more aggressively on felony prosecutions mm-hmm. and juvenile prosecutions. And then it said under Klobuchar's tenure, she went after things that I'm going to he says under Klobuchar, local prosecutors were assigned to police precincts to crack down on smaller offenses such as check forgery.
Mm-hmm.
What got George Floyd mixed up with the police was a call from that food store to 911
about check forgery.
About forgery.
Right.
You put all of this together, and Amy Klobuchar has a record that she has to address, and only because she's being considered for vice president.
Doesn't Kamala have to address that the same way?
I'm sorry. If only Amy Klobuchar had the same amount of scrutiny during her run for president as Kamala Harris had on her record, we might be having a different conversation.
Yeah, and black folks didn't respond too well to that record either. That's why she was fourth in the race in California, which is why she dropped out. She didn't care.
Black
folks
having,
didn't keep her on that stage. I mean,
also, well, black folks didn't keep Cory Booker on the stage either. And
right.
No one was going to stay on the stage, as we know, and as I've argued from the very beginning, that no candidate was going to win the black vote as long in the primaries, as long as Joe Biden was in the race.
Well, what does that tell you?
But now Amy Klobuchar's name is out there as someone who could possibly be vice president. And I'm making the argument that here is why she would be a bitter pill for black voters if she were selected. One, because it's old Democratic Party thinking and old political thinking that you've got to go and get the Midwest, and it's putting white voters
thinking
at the central frame versus a party in the country that is moving beyond that.
Yeah, but the Democrats are already winning where those communities of color are in urban centers,
you're making another mistake.
I didn't finish my point.
Well, most people of color vote in the suburbs than in quote unquote
this is
urban
true.
Areas.
This is true, but the most people of color living in the suburbs, their numbers are much smaller than they are in urban centers. So the concentration levels are what you have to think about. So it's like being a Republican in Prince George's County.
And
yeah, they're Republicans in the county, but in my precinct, there's six of us out of 1,800 voters. So, okay, they're Republicans in Prince George's County. The fact of the matter is, the fact of the matter is, you've got to also look at where your vote is and how you, to your earlier point, mine that vote. And again, this is, you know, it may be old thinking, but until it's disproven, it still works. And that is, presidential campaigns look at the totality of these things in terms of, how does this individual get me something I don't have? And then, of course, there is the, if something happens to me, can they step into the shoes of the presidency? All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, just a quick one. For our wonderful advertisers, you know them, you love them, at least I do, right here, and we'll be back in a moment with more of Jonathan Capehart from The Washington Post.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
We're back and we're talking politics with the incomparable, the wonderful, my good friend, Jonathan Capehart from The Washington Post. I mean, I think your three pieces have been, and as you know, I've commented on all of them, have been excellent pieces. And they again, throw out tentacles that require you to attach and pay attention and sort of follow along. At the end of the day, my view of it is, I can be enthusiastic, I can be fearful, I can be all these things. The question is, has anything that has happened over the last 4 years mattered enough for you to go vote? And this election is not going to be an election about, you know, a lot of the social and political and societal sub stories that tend to sort of roil around these things. This is really about, do you keep this guy in office or do you take him out?
Mm-hmm.
And we can have these debates around who's the number two, or should this person be the number two, or who's the number one, all that. But the question for me is fundamentally, do you want to win or do you want to be woke? Do you want to put in place someone who can transition away from crazy, or do you want to just double down on crazy and just strap in for the next 4 years? Because you thought the last 4 years were fun. Baby, you don't know what's about to hit when Donald Trump gets reelected,
right?
Because then the truth before him is, okay, y'all threw everything at me. Now I got something for you.
And you think he's unleashed now.
Right.
Which, in a lot of ways, he is. Imagine if he were to win re-election, how much darker, in terms of mood, in terms of policies, this country will get. I'm actually working on a part four.
Oh, no.
of my little series. And it's actually meant to address what you just said, the phrase you just said, do you want to win or do you want to be woke? And what was interesting in the first two pieces that I wrote, the reaction that I got back, both on my Facebook page and especially on Twitter, which I know is not a representative sample of anything, but the number of people who said, listen, I'm going to vote. Don't get it twisted. I'm going to vote. But if Biden makes the wrong choice or doesn't put a black woman, mm-hmm. these are people who want a black woman on the ticket, but if he doesn't do that, then that's all he's going to get is their vote, which I thought was a very interesting distinction they were making, because this one person who I'm going to quote in the piece from Twitter said, I'll vote, but that's all Biden will get from me. He won't get my time. He won't get me door knocking. He won't get me phone banking. He'll just get my vote. And that's why I keep coming back to the enthusiasm piece is really important. At the end, and ultimately, that woman or these voters walking into the voting booth and casting a ballot, that's all you really want. But in an election here where both sides are incredibly motivated and are trying to pull out the folks who haven't quite been motivated to vote one way or right. another, you're going to need the door knocking. You're going to need the phone banking. You're going to need that extra $10, $20, $30 that you could get from them every month to help finance your operation. And that's the point I'm trying to get to and why I made the point of saying, you know, no matter what, we're going to get blamed. But do not for a minute think that because some black people are saying we want a black woman to be Biden's VP running mate does not mean that they're not going to vote. It means for a lot of them that their enthusiasm for the entire process will go from 100 to maybe 50.
That's why I
feel so passionately about writing part four, because I think too much of our political conversations, lack for nuance or context, and people just go for broad brushes. And that's why I want to do that.
No, I look forward to reading that and criticizing it. I've got one more. I've kept you a long time, bro. This has been a great conversation, but I do, because again, this is in your space of social and sort of cultural space. Twitter and the president seem to be having a row. Twitter's now decided, or at least in this one instance, have acted on the president's tweets to put a little sort of. What do you call it? An alarm?
Right, little ding-a-ling-a-ling.
Little ding-a-ling-a-ling.
This ain't true.
This is bullshit. No, this ain't true. It's a lie. The president, of course, has reacted to that. Do you think the president's response to, Twitter's response to Trump's tweeting is justified? And what kind of role should any platform play at this point in regulating inaccuracies in their site? I mean, you guys in the media, the Washington Post, have a very high standard of what goes into that print and the words that are used and the truth and the fact checking and all of that. Why do platforms like Twitter and Facebook not have that? Because the free speech argument's a bogus argument, and in my view. And so I'm just curious as to how you see Twitter reacting and responding and what platforms should be doing or will likely do going forward.
This is really tough, and this is actually a conversation that we have on the board that ends up, going around and around and around, because on the one hand, Twitter's a private company and,
right.
they can do X, Y, or Z. They're not a journalism
right.
entity. And so they don't have, they don't follow the same kind of ethics and stuff that we do, and that we feel duty bound. But on the other hand, you've got, there is the issue of free speech. I can see the arguments on all sides of this. And so I'm speaking for myself and not the Washington Post, certainly not the Washington Post editorial board, but it seems to me that when you have the leader of the free world, the president of the United States, spreading falsehoods on the platform that would get any regular person kicked off, put in quote-unquote Twitter jail, why shouldn't those same rules apply to him? I mean,
right.
It's great that they put that little red ding-a-ling bell to warn people like, here, for more information or for accurate information. That's great when it comes to his, popping off about mail-in balloting and voting and stuff like that. Where I have a hard time is Twitter taking no action against the president for spreading conspiracy theories and lies about whether it's hydrochloroquine or murder conspiracies involving our colleague Joe Scarborough, where you have, how do you, as a human being, CEO of a company, and as a company, ignore the pleas of a widower,
right,
who is demanding that you stop someone from abusing you and your family? And it's been 20 years. Yeah. But and the conspiracy theory is a conspiracy theory because it's not true. And yet Twitter is like, oh, nothing to see here. You know, we don't have to do anything about this. And so that's, I don't know. I mean, personally, I if Jack Dorsey were my friend, I'd say, you know, yo, Jack, you really, at what point does human decency come in to your decisions as a CEO and into the culture of your company? At some point that should come into play. But I mean,
it's hard to come into play when the dollar signs are so large in front of
yes.
you. That's the only thing you see.
Right.
It's the only thing
and
you
that,
see.
Exactly. And that's the other thing. And I forgot. That was another thing that has come up is that, you know, the incentive structure, we know what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's why I say the free speech part for me doesn't matter, because the only thing that matters is the Benjamins. And so that's why I got rid of Facebook. I completely stepped off the platform. I closed the account, done. Because I didn't even begin to share with you what I think about some of the people that that are on there. It is a hate-filled, spewing bullshit machine of lies, distortion, and conspiracies 90% of the time. And there's no regulation. And Zuckerberg's just like, hey, dude, I got advertising. You know, I'm good.
Right.
And if he can't take it seriously, I don't play. I'm sorry. I can't play in that space. I will give Twitter props for at least making this move, even though they have been hesitant in doing it. You're right. They are a private company and they're not a government entity. You know, free speech rules constitutionally don't apply to them. Got it. All of that understood. But the core point you make, I think, is an important one, is that there is a social responsibility. There is a corporate responsibility to the broader community. And if you're creating a space where I can go on and say Jonathan Capehart is some lie, some, you know, defamatory thing or whatever, and you just let people keep repeating that lie over and over again and you say nothing, you've got to be held accountable for that at some point. And you know, God bless Joe and Mika for what they're going through. But more important than that is the widower, and his plea was so powerful. You know, what you're doing to the memory of my wife. I mean, this is a man who has not remarried. He's not. That's how deep his love for this woman was, 20 years ago. And it for him to have to now relive this pain so publicly, and you know, at the hands of the President of the United States.
Yes, that's the thing.
Can we?
President.
It's not like Jonathan Capehart or Michael Steele is writing this shit and put it out on the street, right? This
right.
is the friggin' President of the United States. People, get a grip. Get a grip. All right. Okay, Jonathan. I'm going to let you
right,
go,
babe. I can go to work now.
You can go to work now.
Okay.
Jonathan Capehart, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. He's my brother from another mother. His mom's a great lady. She's doing well, I hope.
Oh, yeah. No, she's great.
Good. I always enjoy meeting her. Always enjoy my time with her. I think Jonathan gets a little bit jealous when we're together because.
Oh, please. See, this is all a setup. See, y'all listen. So my mom told me when she first moved to Maryland from New Jersey, that was when Chairman Steele was Lieutenant Governor Steele. And she saw him on TV, and she told me that she thought, that's the most handsome man I've ever seen in my life. And then, they, you know, we all meet up for dinner in Washington, and I, of course, have my mom sit next to Chairman Steele, and it really is kind of embarrassing to see your own mother, like, giggling. But there you have it. She's a Michael Steele fan.
She's a sweetheart of a woman. Great lady. You make sure she stays safe and well and give her my best. And I thank you, Mr. Capehart, for coming on the podcast. All right, folks.
Thanks,
that does it for this episode. You know where to find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast on. Stay loose, stay free, stay safe out there, and we'll catch y'all next time.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. lostgolfballs.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.